functions of our gauge invariant local operators in n equals 4 supriangles in R4 in the planar limit. So that's the goal. It's to study that object there. It's the most fundamental object, if you want, in a conformal field theory. It gives us the two-point functions, the first question you might want to ask. And we have two ideas for computing these objects when lambda is very large and when lambda is very small. When lambda is very large, the idea is to use the dual description in terms of classical strings. So the idea when lambda is very large, it's to first you explore this correspondence between dimensions in a conformal field theory and energies in a conformal field theory in R times S3. This step is valid in any conformal field theory. Then you use ADS CFT, which tells you that the energies of your conformal field theory in R times R3 are also the energies of the strings in global ADS. We saw that the time in global ADS and the time in R times S3 is the same time. The Hamiltonians are mapped to each other, and we should study, therefore, energies of strings moving in this gravitational cylinder. Okay, and this we did. We computed in class two solutions, and yesterday in the tutorial you studied the third solution. So what were these solutions? We studied one solution that was a point-like string with only one angular momenta, and then the only candidate for the dual operator was trace of one of the complex scalars to a power j1, where j1 is the angular momenta. And that one, we saw that the dimension of that one was j1. And actually, we argued and we saw evidence for it at three level, one loop, and strong coupling, that this dimension is protected and it doesn't run. It's the same at any value of the coupling. Then we went to the circular string, that is a solution that already moves in two planes in S5. So it moves now in S3 and not only on a great circle of S5. It already has two kinds of angular momenta. And therefore, it should be dual to an operator with two kinds of scalars. If you remember, the one that we consider there are two equal angular momenta, so it should have the same number of z's and x's. And it should be a linear combination of such operators. But of course, you should ask, which particular linear combination is it dual to? And of course, this is related to the fact that even when you want to study a classical solution with a given angular momenta and so on, there are, of course, many ways, of many solutions which have the same angular momenta and which are different strings. I can have different strings that have the same total angular momenta, but which can move in a very different way. So, okay, so it should be dual to some operator, but we don't yet have a good hint about what it could be. What we said was that this guy is like a solution with no modes excited, this one is with one mode excited, and I told you that the way to think about this one is a solution with two modes excited. And the last one, so what is the last one? The last one is a solution that is not point-like in ADS, but it's rather like a rod, and that rod rotates in ADS, and you draw a folded string. I don't know if you opened the notebook that I referred to in the mathematics in yesterday's tutorial. If you did, you saw this nice picture of the folded string rotating in the middle of the cylinder. So we have these three classical solutions. By the way, the first one was found by Bernstein, Maldestein, and Nastase, the second one by Frolov and Seidlin, and the last one by Gapser, Klebanov, and Polyakov. And this was the behavior for the dimensions when lambda is very large. So just an integer, a square root, a bit more complicated. And in this case, you got some elliptic functions, and in the limit when s is very large, you get just s plus log s plus smaller terms when s is very large. Now, something remarkable happens that I did not tell you about, that maybe if you are interested I can tell you about tomorrow, is that the string description, right now we are just solving equations of motion one by one, but there's actually a systematic way of studying all classical string solutions because the classical string motion turns out to be integrable, to be exactly solvable. So the equations of motion, if you want, it's possible to characterize all possible string equations of motion. And the way in doing that, we will see that there are many more charges than just the global angular momenta, J1, J2, and so on. And having those infinite number of charges, then those are enough to tell you exactly which state you are studying. Okay? So if you have some integrable classical motion, that typically means that you have many conserved charges, Then when you characterize a solution, you don't just tell that I have J1 equal to blah and J2 equal to blah. You also tell what's the value of all the other charges, and that really fixes what solution you are studying. Okay, but now we are at weak coupling. What are we doing? What's the idea at weak coupling? The idea at weak coupling, there's nothing to do with ADS-CFT, it's to use spin chain. So how do we go about using spin chain? So the first step, remember, is to relate the dimensions of the operators with a renormalization of those operators. So that was the first step. We showed that the way operators are multiplicatively renormalized is directly related to the dimensions of this operator. Now, in renormalizing this operator, we find an object which is called the dilatation operator, such that the eigenvalues and eigenvectors of this operator are respectively the dimensions and operators with good dimension of the conformal field theory. So we see that this object looks very much like a spin chain when we identify trace of ZZ, XZ with up, up, down, up, and so on. So we call it a spin chain Hamiltonian. And the eigenvalues of an Hamiltonian is what we call energies. So dimensions of operators are dual to energies in this quantum one-dimensional chain. This was what we computed yesterday. And for your reference, I wrote here what would be the next loop correction. So let's just stare at it. Look, this term here, you see it as lambda squared, but it's exactly of the same form as the previous one. So it is, you can think it's like it corrects the coefficient of the leading one. The second one, it already involves a permutation between sites n and n plus 2. So the range increased a bit. And so on. If you go to higher loops, you will get a more and more complicated Hamiltonian. The for loop Hamiltonian already takes like one page. It starts to be more and more complicated. And remarkably, and this we will start seeing today, these Hamiltonians, they are not any Hamiltonians. They are what are called integrable Hamiltonians. So we will be able to compute all these energies here explicitly. Even though naively the problem is a very large complexity. It's a problem even for this case of diagonalizing a 2 to the L by 2 to the L matrix. Even if, as Andrew pointed out, it's a sparse matrix, it's still very, very hard. And if it were not integrable, we would basically not be able to go to very large matrices. Okay, so this is the global picture. So today, we study, we want to know what are the energies of this Hamiltonian. So today we are solving this problem here. Any question before we start solving it? So now the problem is very well posed. It's a problem of just quantum spin chains. We have that Hamiltonian with identity and permutation. It permutes spins at site n plus 1. And we are going to solve this equation. No. Yes and no. It's a bit hard to define. Well, let's first define what we mean by an integrable system to see how we should rephrase the question in a bit later. We will see that integrability is very easy to define when you have a notion of planar, but when it's non-planar, it becomes a bit trickier. Let's see why. So let's solve this equation. So we want to solve this. So there is one case that we already did. So we know that H, acting on all spins up, is equal to 0. Identity and permutation at each pair of sites does nothing, so this is just 0. Okay? So this is the ferromagnetic vacuum. Now we will consider excitations on top of this vacuum. So what's the simplest excitation around this vacuum that you can imagine? Instead of just all up, what can you imagine as the simplest possible excitation? Sorry? Two down? Why two? That's not the simplest. One down. One spin down. I would say one is simpler than two. So let's consider what we call a single excitation, and this excitation, these spin flips that move in the vacuum of spins up, are called magnons. So let's consider a one magnon excitation. So So we just consider our state psi to be some linear combination of some wave function psi of n times up and a spin flip down at position n. So then this equation here, the first equation, when we act now with Hamiltonian on psi, it will give us an equation for psi that we can solve. But can someone tell me immediately what should be the form of psi of n? Why? But why? Yeah, that's the definition of exponential. Because every time you
do it inside the modes that are neighboring, and then if you do it with exponential, you will get the same contribution because you will get 1 minus a sine or cosine.
It's true. I would say that the reason is that because we have translation invariance. Whenever you have translation invariance, you diagonalize the system by clean rates. Right? You have momentum in, you have translation invariance, momentum is conserved. So the ansatz, the solution will be psi of n equal to exponential of I p n. But let's just see, so this equation here gives the following. It gives energy times psi of n. So we act with Hamiltonian and look at the coefficient of the ket n. So let's call this ket n. So we act at the Hamiltonian and then look at the coefficient of the ket n. So on the right hand side, we get energy times psi of n. Right? What do we get on the left hand side? So I want to act to compute H minus energy or equal.
H minus energy times psi is equal to a sum over n, something times ket n, and that something must be equal to zero. I must set all this something to zero. So I get energy times psi of n. What else do I get coming from the Hamiltonian? Right, but what do you get? You calculate, and what do you get? So you act with the Hamiltonian, right? Now, note what happens. If you act with Hamiltonian, here, nothing happens. You just have identity minus permutation acting on the first two gives zero. Identity minus permutation acting on the last two gives zero. The only interesting part is when identity minus permutation acts here or here, right? So then, if identity acts here or if identity gets here, you get the same wave function. So you get 2 times psi of n. There is one term where the permutation contributes if the spin is at position n minus 1. Then permutation puts it at position n. So there is minus psi of n minus 1. So this is when the spin jumps from position n minus 1 to position n. And there is one where the spin was here and it jumps there, minus psi of n plus 1. Is this equation clear? Just acting with Hamiltonian and reading the coefficients. But please tell me if this is clear, because we are going to do two magnets. If you don't understand one magnet, it will be painful. So today we want to study this guy at one loop. It's simplicity, right? I said, what's the simplest case? One magnet, one loop. Today we do one loop. At the end of the lecture, I can do two loops. But it's very simple to do two loops in this case also, by the way. Why don't we have the overall factor, right? Right, you're right. So this is just for identity minus permutation, but as Ivan said, the normalization is lambda over 8 pi squared. Please tell me, is this clear? Yes. For now, yes. And then we will impose it later. So for now, we are in the realm of spin chains, and we forget that the spin chains are identified.
Because otherwise, Dalimil is saying, but wait, all these guys, they are the same. They are inside the trace. What am I doing writing a sum over n? So for now, I'm forgetting that they are all the same and considering just a usual spin chain ring. But it's more than just a ring, it's a trace. So it's really cyclic, more than periodic. So, but that, for now, we forget about cyclicity and we just study this Hamiltonian. Then at the end, we impose the restriction and we kill all the states that are not cyclic. But that we will do at the end. More questions? So please tell me, is this equation not clear for someone? It's okay. I could do it very slowly. I could act with Hamiltonian, reshift the limits of summation, blah, blah. It will be. I think it might be just not necessary, but tell me. Okay, so if no one wants me to do it, I'll move on. So now you see that indeed this equation is solved by the ansatz, which is a consequence, as I said, of momentum conservation, e to the ipn. So when we plug it here, what do we get for the energy? We get that the energy is equal to 2 minus e to the ip minus e to the minus ip. Or the way I wrote, this one is the one with minus, this one is the one with plus. Exactly as Aether was saying, that when you shift, you get here a constant times the same wave function. So you get these two exponentials times this overall factor here that I will probably tend to forget a lot. So remind me when I do. Lambda over 8 pi squared. And this is, I think, let me write and then we can check. Lambda over 2 pi squared. Is it true? So it's 2 minus 2 cosine. 2 minus 2 cosine is 2 times 1 minus cosine. 1 minus cosine is 2 sine square of p over 2. So that is 4. 4 cancels the 8. Yeah, it's correct, right? So this is the energy of an excitation. We call this epsilon of p. So this is the energy of a single particle or magnon with momentum p. Right? So we have a particle that moves with momentum p. It's e to the ipn and then position n. And the energy is sine square of p over 2. You see, if p is very small, you get just p square over 2. It's a non-relativistic dispersion relation. Now we have the latest version of that, yes? Very good. So we are postponing everything related to boundary conditions, cyclicity, and so on. We will do that later. Good point. What would you get if you would impose boundary conditions? N by n plus L, you should get the same thing. So what does it tell you about P? 2 pi over L, good. But we will do it later. But it's exactly that. So if you impose periodicity, everything we said is correct. On top of that, you quantize the moment of your excitation. Exactly the usual thing in quantum mechanics. But I will impose periodicity later for the n magnon state. So we will do it later for immediately the most general case. We don't lose time now. So we are delaying periodicity and cyclicity, and we are just considering, and we will do that later. So then, now, there's nothing more to learn about single magnon. So now we go to the two magnon case, where our wave function now is a linear combination of a spin down at position n1 and a spin down at position n2. Now, again, we act with Hamiltonian, and we read off the equation for this wave function, which is now a two-particle wave function. Okay? So Hamiltonian acting on psi equal energy times psi will give the following. So now, again, what do? We act with Hamiltonian. We look at the coefficient of the ket n1, n2. right? So we look at the coefficient of n1 and n2. And we get the following. We get on the left, on the right hand side, energy times psi of n1 and n2. And what should I write now? So based on this, what should I write now on the right hand side? Sorry? 4 psi of n1 and n2. So can someone else explain why? It's correct, but why? Because now, okay, let me write. So it will be 4 times psi of n1 and n2. So this 4 comes from where? We have our spin chain. And we have this lattice position be n1 and n2. And we act with Hamiltonian, and then there is a contribution when the identity acts here, when the identity acts here, when the identity acts here, or when the identity acts here. That all those terms contribute to this coefficient of n1 and n2. Yes? Am I going too slowly? A bit too slow, yeah? Just no one is. Minus, there is one term where this guy is one unit to the right and it jumps there. So minus psi of n1 plus 1 and 2 minus psi of n1 minus 1 and 2 minus psi of n1 and 2 plus 1 minus psi of n1 and 2 minus 1. Okay? Is this clear? So say this one is the contribution when I have up, down at position n1, up, down, up. This is position n2 plus 1. This is position n2. And I act with minus the permutation on these sides. Yes. Very good. Exactly. So this is true for n1. Minus n2, their separation bigger than 1. Very good. And then, as you pointed out, there is another equation when they are close, where I have energy times psi of n1, n1 plus 1. Again, please stop me if I'm going too fast, too slow, or something. Energy times psi is equal to what? Okay, can someone tell me what should I write on the right-hand side in case when they are close? Good. 2. Can you explain why 2 while I write? Because now when they are close, there's nothing in between here, right? So there's only the first identity and the last identity, right? Yeah? Minus psi of n1 minus 1. N1 plus 1 minus psi of n1, n1 plus 2. Okay, minus the jumps when the last particle is a bit to the right or the first particle is a bit more to the left. Very good. So these are the equations we need to solve for two magnets. Now, how do you propose to solve them? Now we have to make an ansatz. What do you propose? Oh, yeah, very good. So what we should do, the first thing we could try is to just put two magnets propagating, e to the I p1 n1 plus I p2 n2, right? So this corresponds to having two magnets, one with momentum p1 and one with momentum p2. But indeed, in two dimensions, when you have two particles with p1 and p2, they could collide and just exchange their momenta. So this ansatz goes through the first equation. But it doesn't go through the second equation because they can interact and exchange momenta. So you can have a term S of P2, P1 times e to the I P1, N2 plus I P2, N1. So let me repeat the physical meaning. In two dimensions, when you have two particles with momenta P1 and P2, and they collide, if you have conservation of momenta and of energy, and this is very particular to one dimension, the only thing that can happen is that the momenta can either be preserved or be exchanged. And we should write both possibilities. And the relative coefficient between what's the relative coefficient between the amplitude of doing nothing and scattering is what we define as an S matrix. That's the definition of what an S matrix is. Is the coefficient of the outgoing with respect to the ingoing. Okay, so this is our ansatz. Okay, so this is the Magnan, the way the Magnan scatters. This is the Magnan S matrix. And this is the two Magnans with momenta P1 and P2. Now, if you plug it in that ansatz, what do we get for the energy? You see that the energy doesn't know that N1 and N2, doesn't know that there are two magnets. It's just two, in the same way that this is a discrete Laplacian. That's just discrete Laplacian in both variables. So from the first equation, we just read that the energy is epsilon of P1 plus epsilon of P2. In other words, when we want to measure the energies of the particles, because the interaction is local, we just go to a region where they are not interacting and we measure the energy there. So, of course, the energy should be just the sum of the energies of each of the particles. And if you now plug, this is what the first equation gives. The second equation, when they are close, fixes the S matrix and tells you that the S matrix for momenta P and P prime is equal to 1/2 cotangent of P over 2 minus 1/2 cotangent of P prime over 2 plus I over the same thing with minus I. 1/2 cotangent of P over 2 minus 1/2 cotangent of P prime over 2 minus I. So this state, we can represent it graphically as saying that we have two particles. And then we have, they might scatter. And when they scatter, there is an S matrix. Just a graphical representation of that state there. By the way, you see that the S matrix looks kind of funny with this 1/2 of cotangent of P over 2. So let's make the following observation that e to the ip, okay, e to the ip is nothing but 1/2 of cotangent of p over 2 plus I over 2 over 1/2 of cotangent of p over 2 minus I over 2. If you make full simplify, you get this. Okay? So if you look at this, can you propose, is there a change of variables that you feel almost obliged to do? A nice parameterization of the momenta? What variable would you like to introduce so that the S matrix, which is a good compromise, the momenta is still nice, but the S matrix becomes really nice? It's not a very well posed question, but it's clear. Yes? U equal to e to the ip, it's one possibility. Indeed, it becomes a bit nicer, but even better, one very nice change of variables that we will use is to define u to be 1/2 of cotangent of p over 2. Then you see the S matrix becomes polynomial, the momenta is polynomial, and you make everything algebraic. Okay, it's just a nice change of variables, and this is what's called the beta rapidity. So you see the S matrix is just u minus u prime plus I over u minus u prime minus I. Okay, so far there was no miracles, no integrability. It was just in one dimension, we have conservation of momenta, so single particles must be plane waves. And we have conservation of energy, so when two particles scatter, their momenta can at most be exchanged. But the interesting thing, so let me repeat what I just said. So in two dimensions, when we scatter two particles, P1 and P2, and we scatter them, we collide them, we get another momenta, P1 and P2 prime. But this set of momenta as a set must be equal to the original set because we have conservation of energy, which is some sum of epsilon of pi, and momenta, which is sum of pi. And energy of momenta imposed that at most the energies can be permuted. Okay? So this we know when we learn collisions in high school. Now, on the other hand, in general, if you have P1, P2, and P3, and you collide them, you get a set P1 prime, P2 prime, P3 prime, which is not equal, in general, to P1, P2, and P3. But things become much more complicated. You just conserve energy and momenta. You still have lots of freedom in choosing the final three particles. So as usual, in one-dimensional systems, the challenging part starts always with three particles. Okay? Okay. So, let me follow a slightly different route compared to the one that I had prepared. I think it might be better. Yes. Yeah, just plug this ansatz into the second equation. You already know what the energy is. So you have just an equation for S. Right? Plug into the second equation, impose that, and you get immediately S. That's just plug and make solve. So let's look for a class of theories where we could have something nice happening. Namely, could it be that for some theories, when you scatter P1, P2, P3, so let's ask, are there theories such that when you scatter particles, P1, P2, and P3, you get just the original set, P1, P2, and P3. And the answer is yes, and it's actually very simple. Yes. For example, suppose we have some energy, which we call Q2, which is conserved, which is sum of pj, or some momenta, which is q1, sum of pj, q2, which is sum of pj square. So here I'm doing one-dimensional quantum mechanics, non-relativistic quantum mechanics, just to illustrate the point. But everything generalizes it trivially to the lattice. Suppose we have energy and momenta conservation, but suppose there's something new. Suppose we have a new funny symmetry, which is sum of pj cubed. This would be something new. It would be what we call some higher charge. So let's explore what the consequence of having these things is. So immediately you see that then, if you impose that this guy, and this guy is conserved, then this is true. So if you impose that sums of p is equal to sum of p prime, sum of p squared is equal to sum of p prime squared, and sums of p cubed equal to sum of p prime cubed, then it is true that the only possible solution is to rearrange the momenta among themselves. But then, what would you conclude? You conclude that in theories where we have higher charges, something funny happens. I scatter three particles and I receive the same momenta at infinity. So I prepare three particles, I scatter them, I measure them in my detector, and I see that the momenta was just permuted. So what do I conclude about what is happening inside my experiment? I conclude that the particles were interacting only in a pairwise way. Otherwise, how could it be? Only if I believe in the lottery. How could it be that I scatter three particles, they interact in a non-trivial way, and at the end I get the momenta are just reshuffled? The only rational explanation, what must happen, is that the three-body interaction, the S matrix of three particles, must somehow, the interactions in the bulk of my experiment, must be as if they were just happening in a pairwise way. That's just true for one dimension. Because for higher dimensions, even for two particles, that's not true. I wrote there in two dimensions. When I wrote two, it's one plus one. Of course, yeah? I'm a high energy theorist. Two is always one plus one. So in one dimension, when you collide two particles, the moments are at most exchanged. But then, you see, you have P1, P2. Here you have P1, P2, or P2, P1. They are at most exchanged. Here they are at most exchanged. Here they are at most exchanged. So at the end, you have at most a permutation of the original momenta. Right? That's the only way you could conceive such crazy thing happening. So this is, if you want, what integrability is. Integrability is, if you want, a theory when this happens. This is a definition of an integrable theory. That's our definition of a quantum integrable theory. It's a theory where the particles, they can have still very non-trivial, strongly coupled interactions. But those interactions are as if they were only, they only involve two particles at a time. Okay? So let's see more physically how come. This is what must happen, but let's see that this is what happens. Yes. Yeah. Right. So let me first repeat the argument, and now I will prove this picture.
Okay.
The argument is that I send three particles, I measure the three particles at infinity, and I see that the momenta are just permuted. And I know that the only way this can reasonably happen is that the dynamics of the way they scatter is as if they only scatter in pairs. Because if you have three particles, three balls scattering at the same time, we know we get a big mess. There's no way, why would the momenta just be permuted? The collision really genuinely happens at when three particles collide at a time, right? What property of the three-particle interaction would tell you that the momenta should just be permuted? It's very hard to imagine anything reasonable that could have such property, right? How could you imagine writing a SNS matrix that depends genuinely on the three particles, but such that the momenta of the three are the same? If you think for a while, you see that it's basically impossible. So, but let's show then let's derive this equal sign. For that, let's study the physics of these charges. So what's the physics of momenta? Right? So what does Landau say? Landau says we have translation in energy, we can do the experiment today or tomorrow, so there is a charge which is energy. And we can do the experiment here and there, so we have a charge that is momenta. So momenta and energy, they tell you that if you act on some amplitude in your physical theory, you can shift it in space or shift it in time, and the amplitude is untouched. Right? So that's the one physical meaning of energy and momentum. It's associated with symmetry of translations in space and time. So then the natural question is, what symmetry does this guy generate? This is translations in space, translations in time, what about this one? Right? What does this guy do? It must do something fun if we have such theory with such charge. So let's prepare this picture here. So what is this picture? So each line is a wave packet, right? Let's prepare some wave packets that will scatter at the same position. So let's prepare some wave packet psi of x, which is equal to an integral dp. So I fix some momenta to be some momenta p naught, and then plus I p x minus x naught minus I p squared over 2, that's the energy, t minus t naught. Okay? Right. This is how a wave packet evolves in time, right?
You have the e to the I p x, the energy is p squared, or over 2, I put the normal over 2. So this would be how the particle evolves in time. So where is this particle localized? It's localized at the values where the derivative of the phase, where the phase is not changing much, at p equal p naught, which is the values that the integral is dominated. So this is where the particle is, and that just gives x equal to x naught plus p t minus t naught. Okay? So these are the values where the particle, where you will find the particle, and that's of course the, what you expect. You just find x equal x naught plus velocity times minus t naught. Okay? So these are the values. What values of x and t? So where in space-time is the phase not changing much for p equal to p naught? Yes. No. P minus p naught. This tells I'm putting a particle with momenta p naught that starts at some position x naught and sometime t naught. Of course, we cannot do it precisely because we have Heisenberg principle, so we put a wave packet. Okay? There's no Gaussian profile in the X space. Just a wave. It's a particle with some definite momenta. Right?
And where is this wave function? Where am I? Where will I find the wave function? I will find it in the places where the phase is not changing, right? This is stationary phase. So the derivative of the phase with respect to p equal to zero. Sorry. Fixes that tells me that the positions x and t where this wave function is enhanced are the ones which are related by this equation.
Right? Yes.
So it is still a Gaussian. Yeah, exactly. So this is really a wave packet. It's localized, as John said. It is localized in P naught, we see. And we know, on the other hand, that the Fourier transform also gives a Gaussian, so it's also localized at this position. So this is just a way of seeing. Actually, this is P naught. Okay? So this is the wave packet. This is one of those lines that is moving there. Now let's act on this wave function with a symmetry. Let's act e to the I alpha qn on this wave function. Right? So how does this charge act on the wave function? Why did I write it in momentum space? Because in momentum space, all this action does is integral dp e to the whatever is there plus alpha p to the n. Right? It acts trivially in momentum space. Just multiplicatively, multiplicative action. Oh, by the way, I think it's okay. It's fine. So now, let's see where is the wave packet. And now, because of that extra term, the equation becomes x equal x naught plus p naught t minus t naught plus n alpha p naught to the power n minus 1.
Can you please explain, why do we have this form of action of this charge?
Sorry?
Why do we have this expression that e to the power I alpha q.
So we are acting, we exponentiate some symmetry, we act with this symmetry on the wave function, right? This symmetry I'm writing by, suppose, I wrote it, suppose this symmetry is this. So these symmetries, they act trivially in momentum space. They are just sum of p, p squared, p cubed, right? Do you agree? I mean, in, they are diagonal in momentum space. They are just multiplicative in momentum space. But the wave function is in position space. So I have Fourier transform, and then inside this integral, it just acts by multiplication.
So I just thought that this alpha was in the original expression just...
Sorry. No, this alpha is some width of the original wave packet. Well, let's put a beta here. Thank you. Yeah, good. Yeah, and it's, yeah.
And lower, it's also beta.
And this is beta, yeah, correct. Okay? So you see what happens. What happens when n is equal to 1? So please look at, when n is equal to 1, what you do is you shift your x by a constant. So n equal to 1 just amounts to shifting your x naught to x naught plus some shift beta. When n is equal to 2, you just get p naught, but that's equivalent to changing your time. You just change your t naught by t naught, in this case, minus a beta. Right? So that, these two, they just shift the wave packet. So this just shifts the wave packet in this direction where this is x, and this one just shifts my wave packet in time. That's totally obvious. That's what we know energy and momentum do. But what happens now if you have n equal to 3? The wave packet now is also shifted. Doesn't matter if it's up or down. It's also shifted. Now it goes to a new position. Say this was the original position. But this shift now will be dependent on p naught. It will be a shift that depends on the momentum. So it's a p dependent shift. Right? Is it clear? Yes.
And
the multiply
by
itself
is not the skew, right?
No, it is the same.
Because
here
you have the sum over the momentum.
Yeah, there's only one particle, so there's no sum. I'm just studying a wave packet. If there were three wave packets, for each wave packet, I would do this.
And then the second equation here is t naught minus 2 beta.
Yeah. So we see something very interesting. We have a symmetry. So if this charge exists, it means that our theory has a very funny symmetry. You can shift wave packets by amounts that depend on their energy or on their momenta. But then, so what happens when we act on our experiment? So we act, we have some amplitude for this process. But this is equal to e to the I beta q3 times the amplitude times the amplitude. This is definition of symmetry. But what does this do? This shifts each wave packet by an amount that depends on its momentum. So after shifting, they are no longer scattering at the same position. Because each wave packet is shifted by an amount that depends on its momenta, what happens is that you show that the process factorizes. Right? So this answers your question. Very good. By the way, so any question here? So we show that the S matrix, 3 to 3, can be decomposed as a bunch of 2 to 2 S matrix. Okay? Any question there? So this is therefore, there is a very interesting set of theories, which are these integrable theories, where again, the 2 to 2s matrix can be highly non-trivial. For example, the quantum field theory that follows from these nonlinear sigma models that we were studying are among these examples. They are strongly coupled field theories, as I was arguing the other day. And when you quantize them still, the S matrix is very non-trivial, and it is an integrable theory. So the theory can be strongly coupled, very interactive, but still it has this property that the three-body interaction can be decomposed as a product of two-body interactions. So these are the next to simplest example after free theories. So if you want, this is the natural generalization after free theories. So you have free theories, then you have the most complicated theories, and you have this integrable theory, which are the next to simplest case. Now, back to this question, why two dimensions? This is a very important question, right? So what would happen if we run the same argument, but now these p's are higher dimensional, right? So in our world, we have translations in any directions, and we have energy conservation. What happens if we try to construct these higher charges in higher dimensions, right? You see, nothing would change. The argument would be exactly the same with you had to put some vectors on some p's and some tensors and so on, but nothing conceptually changes. So if such symmetries exist in higher dimensions, it means that you can shift a wave packet by an amount that it depends on its energy. Same conclusion. But then, so everything goes through. But with indices, of course. But then you conclude that if you have three particles scattering, now in three dimensions, if three particles are scattering in three dimensions, they are meeting here, I can shift each of them by an amount that depends on its momenta. So I can easily put them in such a way that they are very far away and they don't scatter at all with huge impact parameters, such that they don't interact at all. But then, this, of course, is just equal to 1. So the S matrix becomes just the S matrix of a free theory. So if you try to get integrable theories or to follow these steps for higher dimensions, you prove that if you try to impose the existence of higher charges in higher dimensions, you end up with a free theory. And this is a theorem. This is a nice way of understanding what's known as the Coleman-Mandula theorem, which is a theorem that tells you that you cannot have enhancement of just usual Poincaré symmetry without immediately falling into the realm of free theory. The way out, you might know. Did you hear before about Coleman-Mandula in your lectures? No? And when you saw supersymmetry? Probably you were told that one of the motivations for supersymmetry was exactly evading this Coleman-Mandula theorem. Coleman-Mandula, what we see here is if the symmetries are of the usual kind, this kind of bosonic symmetries, we reach this conclusion. But actually, it's possible to slightly evade these conditions and still have some enhancement of symmetry if the new symmetries that you add are fermionic. And this is one way of motivating supersymmetry. So supersymmetry is an enhancement of the usual translation, rotation, and so on, which will be the analog of the first two, to a bigger set of symmetries that is entangled with this, but where you can still get non-trivial theory. Now, this is quite a digression. Of course, I'm only telling you this because our Hamiltonian for, I should write on the first one, right? I cannot. Okay. For our XXX spin chain, right? Where our energy, where our operator Q Q2 is nothing but the Hamiltonian sum of identity minus permutation. So this is the analog. We see this is the analog of P squared, but on the lattice, right? It's the one that gives sine square of P over 2. And now you might ask, Q1 is just translations. Does there exist a Q3, which would be some sort of sum of some interaction, and it can be a bit longer. By analogy with that P to the cube, you can imagine that it stretches a bit longer. Does there exist such Q3 such that it's a charge such that Q3 with Hamiltonian, it commutes with Hamiltonian. That's the definition of a conserved charge. So does such charge exist? What's the best way to show that it exists? To write it down. The answer is yes. And let me just write it down. You can check that it commutes. Q3 is sum over n commutator of Pn, n plus 1, with Pn plus 1, n plus 2. How could we have guessed? Well, these charges, they come very natural from a formalism that we probably will not cover, called the algebraic Bittan-Zatz. But of course, with strictly speaking, you don't need it. You could make an ansatz for the most general object that interacts three spins. There are not that many structures. And just commute it with Hamiltonian and find that there exists one that works. Right? You see? I mean, it comes. You don't have to guess if you know this algebraic Bittan-Zatz story. But of course, what kind of structures can you write that interacts three spins? There is this one, there is the permutator, and there is the anticommutator. There are like three structures that you can write. So you could also write those three structures and show that this one has the remarkable property that it commutes with Hamiltonian. Yes?
Symmetry in the phi 1 diagram?
No. That's a good question. Can we understand what is the property of these Feynman diagrams that are giving rise to these higher charges? No. But you can show that you see, when you have an Hamiltonian with SU2 symmetry, and you say, I want to study Hamiltonian SU2 symmetry and in a planar limit. Just a planar limit tells you it's an object that interacts nearest neighbors only. Then the only thing you can write is permutation or identity. It's the only two possible things. But then it's integrable always, because I mean this is just a shift of the energy, and I'm telling you that permutation is integrable. So then it's kind of boring, okay? It's trivially integral. On the other hand, when we did the case of SO6, there were various tensor structures. There was identity, permutation, and trace. You had more than one tensor structure. And there, only for a very particular ratio, you could find the analog of this Q3. So if you try to repeat this exercise for the SO6 Hamiltonian, when we have identity, permutation, and trace, and try to find Q3, you find that Q3 only exists for the particular ratio of coefficients that we find from Feynman diagrams. Okay. But let's finish. Now that we have this, that we see, we are extremely happy. Our Hamiltonian fits in the class of this new class of theories that we just discussed. Let's use it now to guess what a multiparticle wave function must be. Now we know that particles, the momenta, is at most permuted. So it's very easy to write down an ansatz that we know how to work. And this was the insight of Bittan. He proposed this ansatz and he checked that indeed it works. So let's make an ansatz now for three particles for this integrable theory that should work. And it's the following. You have e to the I. First, we put three particles, p1 n1 plus I p2 n2 plus I p3 n3. Okay? But now you know what can happen. The particles can at most exchange their momenta. So there would be six plane waves. Let me write maybe two of them only, or three of them. So there is one, for example, where P2 and P1 are exchanged. There is one, for example, where P3 and P2 are exchanged. And for example, let me write one more where there are, where I exchange a bit more. And what should we put? And there are two more terms. What should we put multiplying these plane waves? You see, in this one, what happened to go from this to this? Particles 1 and 2 scattered with each other. So the guess for the relative coefficient is just put the two-body S matrix that we computed already, S of P2, P1. What happens when you go from this one to this one? P2 and P3 are exchanged. So just put here the S matrix where P3 and P2 are exchanged. What about from here to here? You can think that first you scatter, say, 2 and 1, and you get this. And then you scatter 3 and 2 to get to permute the last two. And you would get, or for example, or first 3, no, sorry. First you scatter this one, so you have S matrix P3, P2. Now you are here. And now you see this one is already good. You change 1 and 3 times S matrix of P3, P1. Okay. Plus two more terms. So let's draw plus, tac, 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 plus, tac, tac, tac. Let's just draw this graphically. What do we have? We have the term where you do nothing, plus the term where the first two particles are exchanged. Can you read if I write here? Is it okay? No? Okay. You have the term where particles don't scatter, plus the term where 1 and 2 are exchanged. The second was the one where 2 and 3 are exchanged. The other one was the one, I think it was this. Let's see. 2 and 3 are exchanged, and then 1 and 3 is exchanged. That's the last one. You see, from these pictures, you can immediately write them down. And then there are just two more. And these are the possible, these are all 3-factorial permutations. Okay? So this is a really remarkable ansatz. Normally, 3-body wave functions in spin chains or in condensed matter or in physics are highly complicated. And here all we are saying is, no, because the model is integrable, all that can happen is the particles can at most exchange their momenta. We have 6 possibilities for the final outcome, and they are all related by a product of a simple set of S matrices. Okay? And we compute Hamiltonian acting on psi equal energy acting on psi, and we find that indeed it works. We just take this ansatz, this beat ansatz. It was motivated by all our discussions, so we knew something remarkable should work, and indeed it worked. In general, now it's trivial to guess. What is the N-Magnan case? Well, we just have psi equal to a sum of the N factorial possible permutations. And we know how to relate different permutations. We just use S matrices. So it's just a trivial generalization of the two-body case. And what is the energy of such state? It is just the sum from j equal 1 up to n of the energy of each of the particles. Just act with Hamiltonian when the particles are separated apart, and you read off the energy. Yes?
Chains of transpositions which lead to the same permutation.
That's right, yeah. But then the coefficient will also be exactly the same because these S matrices are numbers. So what you can have is the numbers can happen in different orders. Right.
But you see, what Ilmari, what Dalimil is saying is that you can have this order, but I could draw the same picture in this way, right? But then what would you write for this case? For this case, you would write an S matrix between particles 1 and 2, an S matrix between particle 1 and 3, times an S matrix between particle 2 and 3. What would you write here? An S matrix between particle 2 and 3, times an S matrix between particle 1 and 3, times an S matrix between particle 1 and 2. So the product of the three is the same. But actually, that raises an excellent point that I was planning on discussing tomorrow. This was okay because the S matrix were numbers. Right? They were just a number, just a face. But imagine particles at internal degrees of freedom. Then this S matrix is not only a function of P1 and P2, it also has indices. It's a matrix that takes two initial colors of the particles and gives two colors at the end, if the particles have colors, for example, or degrees of freedom. Right? So if particles have degrees of freedom, there is a very important constraint on the form of the S matrix. Because I could apply this argument with, say, beta positive that would shift the lines in one direction, or beta negative that would shift it in the other direction. So another consequence is that I could shift the lines in the opposite direction and get to this picture, which is exactly what you are asking. Now, if S matrix is a number, this is irrelevant. It is just multiplying three numbers in different orders, and A times B times C, I can change the order. But if the S matrices were matrices, so if we have internal degrees of freedom, then the S matrix is an S matrix with some indices as A, B, C, D. And then this is a very constraining matrix equation that tells you that if you multiply these 2x2 matrices in one order or in another order, you must get the same, or physically, that not only the scattering factorizes, but the chronological order of the processes is irrelevant. And this very non-trivial constraint is what is called the Young-Baxter equation. Okay, we almost solved this problem. We already have the energy, and this is the anomalous dimensions, right? So we almost solved the problem we wanted to solve. We almost diagonalized this spin chain. But there's something missing. What are we missing? Constraints on what?
The periodicity
and the cyclicity. That's by far the most important, the periodicity. So now this is all we said is fine when we ignore boundary conditions. But now we must not forget that these particles are in a ring. They are in a finite chain. So these guys, these momenta, they are quantized. They are in a box. Of course, they are quantized. So we have to quantize this momentum. And that comes, of course, from periodicity of the wave function. So if you impose that psi of n1, n2, n3 is equal to psi of n2, n3, n1 plus L. This is what periodicity is. Because we have a wave function where you see you write it in a way not to double count, where n1 is smaller than n2. There, you see? So the periodicity tells you that psi of n1, n2 is equal to psi of n2, n1 plus L. Because when you shift n1 by L, n1 starts to be the bigger. Is it okay? So you can impose this equation there. Okay? So suppose you impose this equation here. Right? You impose this equation here. And let's look at the coefficient. So you plug the wave function there, here. And let's look at the coefficient of e to the I p1 n1 plus p3 n3. I think this is the coefficient I want to look at, but let me give me 1 second. Can you read the last line? Yes. Please see the last. It's important that you can see the first line and the last line. So, from let's look at this coefficient on this equation. From the left-hand side, I have 1. You agree? That's the first wave function. It comes with 1. What about the right-hand side? Now I change. I put here n2, n3, and n1 plus l. Then my claim is that the last equation becomes that exponential. Let's see. So p3, you put n1 plus l. So indeed, you get there. n1, p1. For p2, which is at the last slot, you put n3. So you put... The argument is different. For n1, you put n2. No, this is not good. Right, this is not good. Sorry? Give me 1 second. Right, this is not the one I want. I want to take the coefficients of... Okay, let me write the term that I want. The term that contributes to that one is which one? Is, I think it's this one, it must be this. So this one does not. You agree? If you put n2, n3, and n1 plus l in the positions n1, n2, and n3, you don't get that exponential, right? So it must be, I think it's this one. Let's see this one. So this one is equal to S matrix between particle 1 and 2 times S matrix between particle 3 and 1, right? So this S matrix and this S matrix times e to the I, and then it would be now let me write it. So it will be how am I writing? I'm putting here all the n1, n2, n3. And here I want p2, here I want p3, here I want p1. So the last one becomes p1. The first one is what was before p2, and the second one is what was before p3. Okay? So now let's plug. This is the one that contributes to this coefficient. So what do we get? We get these two S matrices, S of P2, P1, times S of P3, P1, times what? You shift N1 by L, N1 appears here.
The previous one was okay, the triangle.
That?
Yeah.
I'm doing something wrong, sorry. Give me 1 second. So, N3 must come with P1. The middle one, which is N2, must become N3. This must become N1.
Don't you just put N1 plus L in the place of N3?
Thank you. Very good. Of course. In the last slot, you put N1 plus L. So times e to the I P1 times L. Oof. I was scared. Yes.
Why is the first equation true even with the n's permutations? I didn't get that.
No, I'm just imposing periodicity. So you see, periodicity is the condition that psi n plus l equals psi of n for single particle. But for more than one particle, remember that these n's are ordered. So you cannot just write n1 plus l here. n1 is smaller than n2. So when you shift, you should... This is what periodicity means. Because N1 is smaller than N2. By definition. Okay. Oof, I was really worried. So, is everyone happy with this equation? So, what's the interpretation of this equation? It tells you that the phase acquired by particle 1 when it goes around the ring of length L, that's the free propagation, plus the phase shift acquired when it scatters with 2 and when it scatters with 3 is equal to 1. So this equation can be drawn as follows. I have particle 1 that goes around the ring, and it gets some phase when it scatters with 2, and it gets some phase when it scatters to 3, and the total phase must be equal to 1. So this is the free propagation. And these are the phase shifts. And this quantizes the momentum of my particle. And now that this quantizes the momentum P1. So let me write down what the final result is. So you have this, so this equation, a similar equation for P2 and for P3 coming from the other exponential. So let me conclude by writing down what's the final result. The final result is the following. So our energies in n equals 4 super young yields are given by the length of the chain plus the anomalous dimension, and the anomalous dimension is lambda over 8 pi square sum from j equal 1 up to n of the sine square that in terms of these variables used are 1 over uj squared plus 1 quarter, where this use, they obey these periodicity conditions that are called beta equations, which take the form uj plus I over 2 over uj minus I over 2 to the L times a product over the scattering with all other particles up to the number of particles, uj minus uk minus I over uj minus uk plus I equal to 1 for j equal 1 to up to n. So this is the full solution for the problem of computing the two-point functions in n equals 4 super young yields for operators made out of scalars, this and that. What you have to do, we simplify the computation. You see how much we simplify it. From doing Feynman diagrams, we simplify it first to computing energies of a quantum spin chain. And then we solve completely that problem. And at the end of the day, all you have to do is solve a bunch of polynomial or algebraic equations that quantize this momenta, which are parameterized by this u. You quantize them, you plug them here, and you get the corresponding delta. Now, there are several solutions to these equations, but that's perfectly fine because there are different linear combinations, different operators that I can consider. So now we are at the same stage as we are at strong coupling. At strong coupling, what are the rules of the game? You fix some global charges, some spins and so on, and you
study classical solutions. But there are many. What about weak coupling? You fix some length of the chain L, and you fix some number of magnets N. So L is the number of Z fields plus the number of x fields, and n is the number of x fields. So this L is what we called before j1 plus j2, and n is j2. So we fix j1 plus j2, we fix j1 and we fix j2, but then there are many solutions, many possible quantum states for this spin chain. So then the question is, okay, now we have two discrete spectra. One coming from string theory, we compute all classical solutions with given angular momenta, and we get some spectra. Another from weak coupling, we fix the number of J1 and J2, we compute all possible solutions, and we get some spectra. Okay? So one thing we could do is just match both lines, or more ambitiously, we could try to understand which state here is mapped to which state there. And that's what we are going to do tomorrow. Okay? So let me see if there's anything else I want to do. I want to mention, I think this I did. So again, the physical meaning of that, those equations are the condition
that I pick particle J.
I carry particle J around the ring. You see, and carrying it around the ring, I acquire a phase, which is the moment of the particle J times L. And the particle J scatters with everyone else, that's K different than J. And there is a phase shift whenever it meets any of the other particles. Okay? So you see that these equations, I could write them down without doing any computation almost. So in integrable theories, what you do is you ask someone, what is the energy of a single particle? That's the dispersion relation. And you ask, what is the S matrix of two particles? Once you have these two very important objects, you just sum over energies, and you plug the S matrix into BT equation. And why does it work? Because when you say, I pick a particle, I carry it around the ring, and the phase must be trivial, that's always true. But in integrable models, you know what it means. It means you by carrying it around, it scatters with everyone else. But because the scattering factorizes, I can take that into account by just multiplying a sequence of two-body scattering. So this equation, in general, all we have to do in any integrable theory is just solve this equation, where here we have e to the I pj times L. This term is the S matrix between particles pj and pk. And this term here is just the energy as function of pj. So the fundamental objects are the energy of a particle, which comes from studying the one Magnan case, and the S matrix of the particle, which comes from studying the two Magnan case. So that's the great advantage of an integrable theory. You study one particle, you study two particles, and immediately write down BT equations, and that gives you the full n-body spectrum of the theory. And you see the complexity of solving these equations is infinitely better off than diagonalizing 2 to the L by 2 to the L Hamiltonians, which by itself is already much better than going through the pain of doing Feynman diagrams. So this is more or less as good as it gets. So tomorrow, we will work with those equations and with the match with strong coupling, and with some comments about higher loops and so on. Yes.
I thought, no, this discussion was exactly telling what the physical meaning is. We see that the physical meaning is, I mean, what's the physical meaning of an object? You describe it by what physical consequences the existence of that object has. What's the physical meaning of momenta? It means that you can translate and the existence of this charge, which is momenta. You can do the experiment here or there and get the same result. If such charges Q3 exist, they have this very interesting physical description that you have a process and you can shift all the processes that are happening by amounts that depend on their energies, and the result is invariant. I think it's very physical. Huh? It might not be intuitive, but I think it's as physical as it could be. I have three wave packets, I shift them by an amount that depends on their energy. And more physical than shifting wave packets. My amounts that depend on energy, I don't know how to do.
So what about the simplicity of the phase?
Very good. Here, we impose periodicity. We impose that the wave function is periodic, right? But actually, we might want to impose more. We want to impose that if you shift the chain not by L, but by one unit, if you shift the full chain by one unit, the state should be invariant. So cyclicity of the trace gives one further constraint. We don't want all the solutions to this equation, but cyclicity of the trace is equivalent to saying that e to the I total momenta, so this is the operator, the unit shift operator, acting on my wave function should give me my wave function. So if I shift all n's by one unit, I should get the same thing. But what happens there if I shift all n's by one unit and impose that I get the same thing? This is equivalent to imposing that the product over j equal 1 up to n, e to the I pj, equal to 1. Right? You impose that the total momentum is equal to 1. Okay? The sum of total momentum, the sum of all the momentum, is equal to 0. So this implies that out of these solutions, we only want the ones. So we select the ones where product from j equal to 1 up to l, uj plus I over 2 over uj minus I over 2, sorry, from 1 up to n, is equal to 1. And that's the condition that we describe n equals 4 super young Mills. So this part is for the XXX spin chain. If furthermore we want n equals 4, we need also this constraint. Now let me make an important comment. If you have a system which is periodic, any system in a box, you have that e to the I p times l is equal to 1, where p is the total momentum. Right? So notice that in any periodic system, in any periodic system, if I shift the full system by l, in any periodic system, e to the I total p times l equal to 1. That is just periodicity. And you can see that if you multiply all bit equations for all j, the S matrices just cancel, and you get that the product of such factors must be equal to 1. Okay? So product of uj plus I over 2 over uj minus I over 2 this product to the power l is equal to 1. That already follows from periodicity. But that does not mean that this guy is 1. It means that this guy is one of the unit of the root units of L. So this guy can be any root of L, right? Can be 1 and so on. So there are sectors. The total momentum is equal to 1. This implies that total momentum is equal to 2 pi n over L. But this condition equal to 1, this one here, implies that the total momentum is equal to 2 pi n. So you see that for the two to be compatible, we need not only this, but we need that this n is equal. We only select particular sectors of total momentum. So the total momentum is quantized, that's a constant of heat equations. So naturally there are sectors, okay, the total momentum is 2 pi n over L, 4 pi n over L, 6 pi n over L, and so on. And we are saying we select one of these sectors, the sectors which are the multiples of L. Okay? So it's a trivial restriction to impulse. Okay. Are there more questions?
Does it say that the energy of one magnon is 0?
The energy of one magnon? So it does tell you that you see that if you try to now impose this for one magnon, indeed for one magnon it's impossible to satisfy. But that's the statement that we knew. There are no excitations in one magnon, because one magnon, the trace, you can put it wherever it is, and you cannot put you cannot create a single magnon state in n equals 4. A single magnon, by definition, is always a sum over all possible ways of putting it. It's always a descendant of the vacuum. That's what we saw yesterday.
Why do you want n equals 4? Like, how is it connected?
No, that n equals 4 is n equals 4 of n equals 4 super young Mills, not n equals 4 of number part.
Yeah, but why? Like, how is that?
No, that n is not the n of the number of magnons. I'm saying that this box is the solution of the XXX spin chain. And d plus this part is the solution of n equals 4 super young Mills. I'm saying n equals 4 super young Mills is a subset of the Heisenberg spin chain.
I just don't understand why this condition is connected to like supersymmetric plane.
No, this condition is related to the fact that you are dealing not only with a closed spin chain, but with a trace. You see, a trace tells you that if you have cyclicity, you can shift all sides by one and you have the same state. So you are only interested in states that have this property that if you shift everyone by one unit, you shift Ni. This just shifts Ni to ni plus 1, you should get the same state. That's just because of the trace. But if you shift all n's by 1, it tells you that the total momentum must be a multiple of 2 pi.
So you're saying that like main states for this chain are mapped to one state?
They simply don't exist otherwise. For example, when we have a single particle, right? This condition tells you that t is equal to 2 pi n over l, right? But for n equals 4 super n mils, only n equals 0 is good. For n equals 4 super n mils, right?
Yes. Because the total momentum must be not 2 pi n over l, that's true for any system, but must be a multiple of 2 pi. So the only possibility is either 0 or l, but 0 or l is the same. They are in the same real and so. So you see, with two particles, you see that p1 must be equal to minus p2. It must have opposite momentum, so that the total momentum is 0. So this gives you some restriction on the states that you can consider, the cyclicity of the trace. It's very simple to impose this constraint and to select out of these equations the ones that have cyclicity of the trace. You just need to select the correct roots of unity that come out. And I will explain how to do it in detail tomorrow. Do these equations, do they resemble something that we have seen already? These equations to you, do they remind you of something we saw? This kind of equation. If you take the log, for example, of those equations, do they remind you of something? They are very similar to the equations we have for the equilibrium position of the eigenvalues in the matrix model. If you take the log, then you can also think of these U's as being positions. And then there is an interaction between the U's, which comes from the S matrix. You have some potential that comes from the first term, and so on. So I urge you to go back and study this interaction picture in the matrix model, because tomorrow we will use it to solve this equation.